to a point in musical development that is so far removed from what church people in the past centuries had to deal with. And I'm speaking mainly of the fact that the whole musicology area has made it such that we have at our fingertips now such a far wider availability of music to perform that it is, I think, more inherent than ever on people to have a broader knowledge of what all of that music means. It isn't enough to me as a church musician to just simply say, we're going to sing this piece or we're going to sing that piece without giving the congregation something about what that particular piece implies. I don't mean necessarily that every Sunday has to be a music lecture in a Sunday service, because I don't believe in that happening. But a few words in the bulletin, a few chosen words, something in the midweek paper that goes out, or perhaps something that is said from the pulpit, but maybe by the minister, much better than by me, I find is very helpful. Basically, I feel very strongly that we should, if possible, do everything in English. But there are times when there are pieces you simply can't do in English because of the fact that no translation makes them work, and they therefore become very choppy, and the piece simply ends up suffering. In those cases, I think there's nothing wrong on a Sunday morning with hearing something in another language. Most often that language is going to be Latin, since of the majority of music in the past was written in Latin. But nonetheless, if that's done, there's no reason that you can't have a translation put in the bulletin. And I would never have a choir sing in Latin and not have a translation, certainly not. I mean, you've got to involve the people. So it was much the same way as at our Eucharist Sunday night. There was nothing wrong in having the choir sing something in Latin as long as, before that, the person in charge mentioned what the text was going to be. Then the thought is at least expressed and people are aware of what we're talking about. I try always to do translations, but they don't always work. If you go back in choral music, there are a few things that you really do need to keep in mind. And where we are at today, I think, makes it difficult for us to start back 500 years. But we need to. First of all, the lack of development of instruments 500 years ago is really phenomenal. It's so easy to think of everything as just the way we know it today, and yet that certainly is just not the case. There were so many instruments that we have today which simply did not exist in the state in which we know them today 500 years ago. And the supreme instrument 500 years ago, bar none, the supreme instrument was the voice. It was what was the one common element. The voice, not of the mixed women and men's choir, but primarily the voice of a male chorus. Men were trained in several different ways in those days. One way they were trained was to just simply develop their falsetto. And what we would call this is a countertenor. And we still have a lot of it today. You find it especially in English choirs. And there are some folk who are still around who do this kind of thing. And in fact, it's becoming more popular than anything, trying again to achieve quote unquote authenticity, whatever that means, since we don't have anyone living from that period. But nonetheless, people trying to achieve that kind of sound of authenticity by doing countertenor. Now, every man in this room has a falsetto voice. We all, it's something that we have and can develop. Some people have developed it to a fine state and some of us have never used it. But we all have that point beyond which our voice flips out of that, of the voice we have into that kind of sounding voice. And some people can develop that. And I mean, I've done this with my kids where a record will be on or something will be on the radio, and it happened about 2 weeks ago. They were playing a Bach cantata and they were trying to do it in a very authentic style, and so they had a man doing the alto part as a countertenor. And I said to my daughter, who's singing that, man or woman? And she said, well, because you asked me, I know it's a man. But if you hadn't asked me, I would have thought it was a woman. And I said, again, it was a different kind of sound. They were concerned that since the voice, 500 years ago, was the sublime instrument of all, find all of the colors that would be possible for the voice. And among those colors was this countertenor sound. Another possible color, of course, was the boy soprano sound. But you will find that music of that period never went that high, because boy sopranos just didn't and still do not go that high. I'm not going to get into the whole technical problem of the fact that pitch has changed in 500 years, because that throws another, I mean, that's another whole lecture. But it was only in the late 19th century, honest and true, it's just, these are the kinds of things that to me are just phenomenal. It was only in the late 19th century that everybody around the world agreed that this was A. This particular sounding pitch, because in many places this was A, or this. But they all agreed, you know, there was a big conference, I think it was in Geneva, and they all agreed that when you had 440 vibrations per second, that was A, and then you worked from there. I mean, there are wonderful stories. One of my favorites is Sir Thomas Beecham going out to a little orchestra out somewhere outside of London, out in the provinces, and of course, the pitch could vary somewhere, and he stepped to the podium and wanted the orchestra to tune and said, "A good morning, ladies and gentlemen, could I have the local A?" You know, and very typical kind of thing to happen. And the problem of pitch was one of the great ones that they had. Also, another way that that sound was achieved was there was a particular decree that went during the Middle Ages regarding the sounds of voices in the choir, and it was thought to be of the highest calling if a man had if still in childhood the man had a voice that was particularly ravishing, that when he was still a boy, that an operation was performed to castrate the child, and thereby hopeful, that's the only word, hopefully retain that sound through transition into manhood, and that would be then, therefore, that person was called a castrato. And this was, again, a voice that could go much higher. Now, what's amazing is the number, I mean, the hundreds upon hundreds of parents who, because of, well, many things. Number one, I mean, castrati were held in extremely, I mean, they were the Beverly Sills of the world. I mean, it was really something. If you were a castrati, it was also a terrific way of making money, I'll tell you. I mean, it was a real thing to be a castrato. The sad thing is that for every, the figures are something like, for every 100 people who had, for every 100 boys who had the operation performed, it failed to carry the voice over in 99 of them. And those who failed, whose voices did not last, were the absolute outcasts. Because they, you know, sexually they were impotent, and they had nothing vocally going for them. And so they were absolutely the dregs. But for those who made it, this was, and we know, of course, in the music of Handel, all of those Handel operas and oratorios were written for specific people, and all of those alto and some of the soprano arias were written for marvelous castrati. The last castrato was a man, there's a whole story on him, and he lived into the 19th century. And it's rather fascinating to hear his story and how, his life, the one who had made it. But then, anyway, a decree later changed all of that. The kinds of phenomenal things that I'm speaking about that are so modern, it was not until about 1850, just 100 years ago, a little more, that it was finally agreed that the conductor would lead the orchestra. Prior to that, of course, in the Baroque time, there was no conductor, and it was the concertmaster who led, you know, a little nod of the bow, and off you go. And that stayed with until, you know, you got later on, and then the conductor was added because things became more complicated, but not everyone agreed to accept a conductor. And there is a famous performance of Mendelssohn's Elijah in London in the 1850s, where half the orchestra went with the conductor and the other half went with the first violin, because they still hadn't agreed on this thing about who would be in charge. These things are so recent for us. Another thing that was very prevalent a long time ago was the fact that the way a beat was kept in instrumental music was by means of a large stick, a very long stick with a metal point on it. And you kept the beat by banging the floor with that. And so, you know, about every four beats you'd hear this thing going on. And you know, you say, but the music, well, that was, I mean, you know, if people are authentic, they would have this banging still go. And we know that went on because one of the famous musicians, Lully, in the French court, missed and it went in his foot and he died. I mean, he got gangrene. It was a very, very prevalent kind of thing going on in music. Since vocal music was of the highest degree, it stands to reason that in the church, skip all of these color factors that I've just mentioned, but with all of that in tow, it would stand to reason that the music being written for the church would be music of the highest degree, and that everyone's best efforts, so to speak, would go to the church. Well, that's exactly what, of course, was happening. And the music from about 1450 until very roughly, but from about 1450 until about 1600 or 1650, vocal music reigned supreme. And I am absolutely overwhelmed and astonished and all those other things to discover the few number of churches who put that kind of music in their Sunday morning services. When later on other things happened and instruments came into the fore, and music, choral music was still wonderful. That's, you know, it's not that it went and it is bad later. But at this time, it was the most important thing. And as I mentioned to the choir earlier this evening, one of the great things about singing Renaissance music, medieval and into the Renaissance, is everybody has a solo. Nobody has an accompanying part. And I urge you, if your church never sings Renaissance music, I mean, they just ought to get interested in it and do it. It's the best thing. First of all, it's wonderful for your choir. It's the best way to get a choir to develop some self-reliance and independence, because everybody's got a solo part. Nobody can follow anybody because everybody's part is important. What I mean by a solo part, just so that we're all clear, is that if you were singing a number, say, of 19th century origin, the soprano part might have this line. Oh, a nice melody line. And may I play the alto tenor bass? Not exactly, you know, the most thrilling thing to get involved with. It is not to say that the piece is bad. It's just that the alto tenor bass part were relegated to a much more accompanying sort of thing. So that the sopranos, of course. You know, they have a wonderful part. They're having a grand time while the others are going, oh, for, you know, that kind of thing. But when you do music that's in the Renaissance, everybody has a wonderful part to sing. And you do some of those motets by William Byrd, by Thomas Tallis, by Wilkes. They're just stunning pieces of music. This summer, I've got the choir at Plymouth singing a Renaissance motet. The Plymouth choir sings two anthems every Sunday. So for one of the anthems, I'm having them do a Renaissance motet every Sunday. Well, they're just ecstatic. They said, I mean, there's just, you know, people who haven't had as much, because in the summer it's a volunteer choir. And so they come in and they go, what's this, you know, and you have a little William Byrd, and they go, oh, I've got a nice part, You know, they're so used to not having a nice part. You go, well, yes, but you always have a nice part in Renaissance music. And it is, and they're wonderful. But you must listen to it differently. That's the other thing. When you as a listener come to a service and they're singing Renaissance music, you can't say, I can't follow the words. Because that's not what Renaissance music was all about. Renaissance music was to glorify God by the highest achievement of vocal grandeur. And vocal grandeur did not mean everybody saying the same word at the same time in the same rhythm. And you just simply have to regard that style of music as the kind of music where that you look at the text. It's what we talk, you know, it fits so well with signing. You know, in signing you don't do every word, you do an image. And that's exactly the way you should listen to Renaissance music. Listen to it as for an image. And, I mean, an image of the whole piece. And you'll hear, you know, there'll be a sentence. And it usually fits in sentences very well. Any particular motet will do sort of a beginning, a middle, end, or whatever, if there were three sentences. And follow the way that they set these lines and what they do with them. Now, in music of the Baroque, you still continue to have this this interest in the vocal. It did not diminish, but instruments became more refined. By the time we get to around 1600 to 1700, there was the interest in vocal music had faded a little bit. You know, it's human nature. You never stay with one thing forever. You go on to something else. So people got interested in vocal, in instrumental in music. As the instruments became better, they got rid of more of the bumps and grinds in the instruments. They made better sense. I mean, there were many years, decades, as a matter of fact, when there are only certain keys that you could use certain instruments in. I mean, it's if you were interested in going through, let's say, Bach and Handel, but Handel particularly, you would find, for instance, the trumpets rarely play in any key except D, because that key they sounded good in. You'd never find, Handel simply did not write them in F sharp. I can clue you right now, forget that, you'll never find it. Occasionally in G, but always in D. And that's why things like are in D and not in C or in E. They're in D because if you want to add the trumpets, you've got to make sure they work in that key. And follow that logic through with other instruments. I mean, obviously you're also limited by range and if you know, what you want it to go down to. When Mendelssohn, 200 years later, wrote, "Be thou faithful unto death and I will give thee a crown of life," as a gorgeous tenor aria, and he wanted it backed up by a cello solo. He wanted it in C major. Why? Because the cello, he wanted it to be an expressive line and the cello can only go down to C. Therefore, if you're going to expand the cello line, the tenor voice can kind of go in and out and around, but the cello has a certain limitation. And so to make that last line, and when the voice is ended and you're going, and you end there, I mean, how nice to have that, you know? I mean, you can't put it in B flat and go, you know, and leave it. I mean, it wouldn't work. Or go, no. So you end down there. I mean, those kind of considerations have to be taken into account. When you listen to Baroque music, even as you listen to the beauty, you can then more and more start to listen more for what I call word painting. It was present in the Renaissance, but the Renaissance music you need to listen to very broadly. Whereas in the Baroque, you can listen much more to specific kinds of word painting. Let me give you a few examples. And the next time you hear a piece by Bach, or Handel, or Buxtehude, a little bit less with Buxtehude, but anybody whose music was basically 1650 to 1750, in that kind of period, there's an enormous concern for word painting. Enormous concern. For instance, let me give you a few very obvious examples. If you're talking about heaven, you always go up high. And if you talk about hell, you always go down low. I don't know of an exception in the repertoire. They just simply never said, you know, on to hell and heaven. I mean, they just didn't do it, you know. It's an obvious kind of thing. It was a subliminal listening thing, and they expected the listener to do that. But we come to music, and we sort of just, you know, I don't know what people are listening for, but we need to have these things to hang on to. In the Baroque, you've got that another thing that they often did. There are so many kinds of word paintings that I mean, the Baroque one is especially tough because I have to be very concise. That's one kind of word painting, the particular word painting. When you have in Handel's Messiah, I know that my Redeemer liveth. Every time the soprano says, I know is higher than I. It does not sound affirmative to say, it sounds like you don't know. It sounds much more affirmative to say, that has a much stronger ring to it. And you always will find that kind of thing. You find particular words. Now, the one caution I would give you, if you are listening to Bach or someone that's been translated, you got to make sure the translation is a good one. Sometimes people just did any old kind of translation. And when the translation is not good, you know, sometimes, and I've seen this happen on a number of occasions, the translations have nothing to do with the original text. And therefore, you know, the word painting is out the window because it has nothing to do with, you know, what was going on. When composers, they did word painting by rhythm. When you find this kind of rhythm, for instance, in Messiah, I'm using Messiah just because it's probably the best example that we're on common ground with. When you have this kind of thing, you can be assured it's always something with whips or beating, that kind of thing, that kind of jagged rhythm. It only happens in about three places that I can recall right now in Messiah. It happens in the chorus, "Surely he hath borne our griefs," where you realize that the reason he bore them was through the scourging. And you get that kind of rhythm. Or when the alto sings, "He was despised," and finishes the whole first part, and then does the middle section of the aria, which most people never hear because the alto doesn't bother to do it, and they finish the first part, and ends, okay. Then there's the whole middle section, "He gave his back to the smiters." You know, here's your whipping. The other one is when the tenor sings, "All they that see him laugh him to scorn." Well, automatically, that rhythm implied a certain kind of picture. And that kind of thing needs to come through. When a composer does something like this, I'm in the wrong key. There we go. Well, you should right away get an idea of some kind. You may have the wrong idea because there's more than one that you might apply. But, I mean, this is not triumphal, you know, and it's not particularly happy, you know, but what Handel is doing there, as a matter of fact, is an oozing sort of thing, creepy, you know, spreading out. And he was trying to get oozing out, and so what did he do but start with one note, and then he went to two, then he went to three, to four, five, six, and kept branching out. For what text was he using it? For the text, "Behold, darkness shall cover the earth, and darkness comes on little by little." And that's just what he did. When composers are setting triumphal music, they almost always are in 4-4 time. That's fairly standard to have. You don't usually triumph in 3. You more than often triumph in 4. If you're going to be, you can almost count, however, that if it's going to be shepherd time, it's 6-8. dum, da dee, da da. It's like lullaby, woo dee doo. And what do we have that's in 6-8? He shall feed his flock. You know, just right in 6-8 time. We're not only concerned about a specific word, they were concerned about a particular rhythm, and they were also concerned about a key. They were concerned about a key not only to show, what instruments could play in certain keys, but also that certain keys describe certain feelings. Now, I am a firm believer that keys have character, and that D major of two sharps is different. Not only is it different, just the notes are different, but it has a different feeling than E major in four sharps. If I were to play you a bunch of keys, not too many so that you're confused, but a bunch of keys, you would, if you were trying to listen on this level, you would say, well, that key sounds brighter. I mean, it sounds something more forceful than this other key. Or that one sounds warmer. For instance, it's the texts that are the tender texts are always in flats. They're not in sharp keys. There's just something about the tenderness and the feeling of flat keys that gives you, you have something about this key that is much more tender than, say, this key. E flat and A major. They each have three. One's got three flats, one's got three sharps, but they're just different kind of quality. And those kind of things also composers went for. Now, obviously, on a Sunday morning, if you hear something, you say, well, I don't have perfect pitch and I wouldn't recognize that. Okay, but the fact is it's there as a sense of something, you know, it's another level. They went for all of these levels, this very strong sense of picturing music. It was an extremely strong thing with them. Listen for it in Baroque music, and when you see on a Sunday morning that a choir is singing something that's in that period, hopefully when they list a composer in your bulletin, they list his dates as well. They should. Then you, as a congregation, I go back to Martin Luther's old thing that, you know, we are there in music not only to inspire but to educate. And it doesn't take much more room to just put the dates under the composer, and doesn't take the secretary much longer. I think it's a very helpful thing to have. You might know Bach and Handel, but what if they sing Gasparini? You know, you go, what's that? You know, it may sound like a dish to eat or something, but you lose out, or some other very obscure composers that come along. Then you go beyond the Baroque. By the time we got to 1750 and the Baroque had ended, instruments had achieved a great proficiency. The biggest problem in the period between roughly 1750 and about 1900 gets us into the whole problem number one of where the church was at. Which in the Protestant church, not in a very good state. A lot of things about worship had become appalling. And this is why in the 19th century, there were a number of calls. Wesley was one among many who called for church reform because of the incredible abuses. The church in Rochester, England, it is known that during the period of one particular rector, they were required during his 30 years to sing the same 9 anthems. Well, I can assure you there's not a lot of real excitement going on in that church. I mean, you'd pretty well know the 9 anthems early on, and your interest in being in the choir or the congregation would not increase with time. And in addition to that, of course, what it simply did was led to all kinds of abuses. I mean, it's the problem we always have if there's anything that we know too well. It's one of the things that I think we have to always struggle, for instance, when we have any kind of liturgy that is just so easy to just kind of not think about and just simply to do. It's why with hymns so often I try, if it's a hymn that's very familiar, I try to throw the words on a new tune. It's why with hymns so often I try, if it's a hymn that's very familiar, I try to throw the words on a new tune. I think it helps people to think of them in a new light. For as an example, as long as the meter is the same, if you take a hymn like, well, let's take a real familiar one, What a Friend We Have in Jesus. Well, that old melody that it's set to lends itself to great scooping and scraping. People do not tend to sing it with any dignity. They sort of slide everywhere. And by sliding everywhere, the text becomes extremely, well, the text just doesn't have much importance anymore. And you get this, what a friend we have in. I mean, it just kind of slides all over. And, you know, and suddenly the idea of Jesus as a friend does not have any great strength. Becomes very kind of maudlin and well, just simply not something that one becomes very interested in. But take that same text and sing it to the Welsh hymn tune Ebenezer, which is the one that is often used. We sang it here a few nights ago to Once to Every Man and Nation. And you go, what a friend we have in Jesus, all our sins and griefs to bear. Well, it's a completely different piece. And the text is like, boy, what a strong text that is. You know, next to... You know, right. I mean, you know, same tune. I am not downgrading either tune. I'm just simply pointing out that sometimes familiarity breeds a certain contempt that tends to make us not, you know, reflect it. I am sure that at the very first time it was sung and written, there was a greater dignity about the Lord's Prayer setting by Alfred Hay Malott than in what exists today. And one of the reasons many people do not like to sing it or play it is, in fact, the abuses it has suffered over the years. And I remember when I, at Plymouth, pulled out John Stainer's anthem, God So Loved the World, it was greeted by several people saying, first of all, you're kidding. You know, that was how, you know. And I said, let's just sing it without all of the pushings and pullings that that anthem has been given over the years. Let's just sing it straight. Let's not hold every other measure for a long moment of syrup. Let's just go on our way. Let's just sing. And just do it. And I said, do it as a very simple, I said, if you wish, think of it as a little madrigal. Think of it as a little light Renaissance piece. Nothing, don't, you know, well, after it was over, you know, some said, well, I still don't like it, but I must admit it's an awful lot better. You didn't sort of go, God so loved the world, you know, and just pull the piece to complete, you know, stretching. I mean, it just pulls it apart. Well, that piece and many others were the result of this whole period. What also happened, don't forget, is that people got tired of church music. The composers I'm speaking of now, they got tired of writing for the church because now that instruments were so good, it was more fun to write for instruments alone because now they could do that because the instruments were now in very good shape. And it is only after the Baroque that you see the real growth of this thing called the symphony orchestra, which came into play and brought you composers like Mozart and Haydn and Beethoven, and who said, I love to write for the orchestra without any other voice with it. Not that they were anti-voice, but they were interested in the sound of the orchestra. The Renaissance had given you choral music with lots of sound possibilities, but nothing like this. I mean, boy, take all those together and add harp and everything else and percussion and, you know, I mean, it was a phenomenal kind of thing. So that when you get into the 19th century music, you have to realize that the 19th century was not, in choral music, a great century. This is not to say that there wasn't some good music written, but the focus of the greatest composers was not solely on music for the church. And many of the pieces which were written during the 19th century were not written for the church at all, if they had a sacred text to them. Pieces like, say, the Verdi Requiem, never was it written for church. Beethoven's Mount of Olives, which is seldom heard, but its last chorus is often the big hallelujah chorus from the Mount of Olives. Oh, it's a wonderful piece, but it was never written for church. It just happens to be that he liked that sacred text and said it, and we have a great piece of music. But one of the things we, I think, have to bear in mind with the 19th century more than any other is that you often find when you talk to people about 19th century music, they say, oh, no, it may not be a great piece of music, but the composer was sincere. There's a wonderful quote that I'm sorry I didn't bring with me, and I don't have it committed to memory, about let us not confuse sincerity with quality. And just because someone is sincere does not necessarily, I mean, you know, someone could say, I sincerely wanted to shoot someone. You know, you can't mix up those ideas. So in the 19th century, there's a great deal of music that is on a far lesser plane. Partly, the choirs were no longer very good. It was in about the 18th century that women began to sing in some churches, and then more of them in the 19th century were introduced into church choirs. Depends on the country and the religion, etc. But gradually, by the 19th century, you had women singing in the choirs, but you had not, there was not the dedication of the best composers to church music. And so the composers who were writing church music were often those who were of second or third rate quality. And there was also, however, at this time, and this is one of the reasons why we still in the 20th century often fight over the preponderance of much poor 19th century music. It's because in the 19th century is when they started mass producing choir music. Around 1850 is when it started, 1850, 1860. And what did they mass produce? What was being sung at that moment? What was being sung? all of this second and third rate quality stuff that was being churned out. Composers, you have to remember, did not write for posterity. Bach never was writing for today. Bach wrote for the time. We know that Bach wrote over 400 cantatas. We have only 200 of the sacred ones left. The others were used for, wrapping paper, garbage, or whatever, and they've been destroyed. We don't have them anymore. They were writing only for the moment. And therefore, in the 19th century, composers that were being heard were those who were, for the most part, living. That's why it was such a phenomenal event when, in the late 1840s, Mendelssohn reintroduced to Europe the Bach St. Matthew Passion. And everybody went, my word, what is this? It hadn't been heard. I mean, people were just astounded at this quality of who is this? There had been a low current of Bach had been heard throughout since he died, but not any great thing. I mean, not in a majority of churches or a majority of places. So it was a phenomenal kind of event to bring that to pass. And there were only a few pieces, Handel's Messiah among them, that lasted through the 19th century. When you get to the 20th century, suddenly there were so many things. There's this interest in history, and so all of this old music began to be rediscovered. And in addition to it being rediscovered, there were composers saying, "I don't want to follow the style of writing that's been around. I want to start a new style." You have finally in the United States their own style of music in the 20th century, and no longer can you really, I can't pinpoint for you in the 20th century when you're listening to choir music a style of music. I can't say that there is just one style because there really are several. There's a kind of a folk style that I think is very recognizable. I have absolutely nothing wrong or nothing against folk music as long as we think in terms of quality in folk music the way we think in terms of quality in other music. But it's very easy to say, well, since it's this, it can be anything. And that's where I just totally disagree. Composers like Bach even had their bad days, and I wouldn't just go around saying everything Bach wrote was bad. I mean, there were days when Mozart and Bach had to get up in the morning and have a piece of music ready, and they had a bad headache, a stomach ache, who knows what, but they still had to write. And you go through and play all the works of those composers, and you say, this isn't as inspired as that. It's true. They all have these kind of things that happened. But nonetheless, in the 20th century, there are certain kinds of styles. There is an enormous amount of music that I call sacred Hollywood, and perhaps it is not as, in your church, it is not as prevalent as it is in perhaps another church, and yet it's an enormous market, and I have to say market because I don't know any other word. It is the kind of music where people say worldly things are not for me, and therefore I will shun this kind of thing as being worldly or that kind of thing as being worldly, and I will not listen to this kind of text. But what they will do is borrow this kind of music, so to speak, movie music if you will, and put sacred music, sacred words to it. When Carolyn and I were married, I played some of that because I know that tradition real well. And I played some of her, and she said, "Oh, you can't believe this is, you can't be serious. People don't sing this kind of thing." I said, "Oh, yes, they do, in lots of churches. And they regard it very much as a very sincere kind of music, and yet they don't see any discrepancy between that and their particular theology." And they simply have changed the words. It would be like, it's time for an example. Let's see. It was his love for me that nailed him to a tree to die in agony. Wonderful poetry. For all my sin. Okay. You say, oh, it isn't. Oh, yes. You know, I mean, my number one problem with that is not a problem with the music per se, because the music could fit for something. But the fact, I mean, stop to think about the lyrics. I mean, there isn't, you know, it could be said so much more in a way that had a lot more depth somehow to it. But to make agonie, you know, fit just because it had to rhyme with a tree, and, you know, it almost becomes a case of, you know, accents on the wrong syllable. And, You're losing a word picture. You sure are, right. There are, of course, those composers who tried to make music so complicated in the 20th century that they've lost a majority of the listeners, and they say, ah, the listener is wrong. And that, of course, I think we are finding in about this time now that there becomes almost a middle level. You need to challenge your ears beyond what they perhaps are wanting to do. I mean, it's the same thing when Beethoven wrote the Ninth Symphony. People said it was noise. And Brahms wrote the First Symphony, and they said, oh, just, you know, just cacophony. Who'd listen to that? And now we say, how could they say that about Brahms? I mean, that old First Symphony, it's easy to listen to. Well, it wasn't back then. So we always need to have composers who are pushing us a little bit beyond what we can expect, but not to a point that's so completely removed that we can't accept it. Part of that whole thing is in how you, in your own church, how you bring the congregation along. I did an experiment at Plymouth one time. I put on a piece of electronic music. It was a piece for electronic tape and choir. And I said to the congregation, imagine 500 years ago, you went into worship in church, and for the first time, something was new that had never been in your church ever. It was called an organ, because of course it only did happen in the Middle Ages. And I said, and it was a new sound. I mean, a real new sound. Think of that as you listen to this piece for electronic tape, the first time we've ever had a tape, a synthesizer, in our church. So we did it. People loved it. It was wonderful because they had been associated, they had something to relate to. A year later, I did another piece, no intro, just do it. Oh, this is awful. This is the worst thing I've ever, how could you call this music? This is just terrible. People forget. And they had not remembered, and it was, you know, the same kind of piece. One was on Pentecost, come Holy Spirit. The other one was on the beginning of creation. Both texts lended themselves to that kind of pictorial thing that you could do with a tape. When you said, come Holy Spirit, and it was all kind, it was wonderful. But people said, oh, it's just, this isn't music, you know. I hadn't brought them along. I thought, well, they'll remember. They don't, you know, once a year is not a good enough memory, I'm afraid. You have to bring people along and remember that kind of thing. So when we come to the 20th century, the problem that we have that they never had in an earlier century is that we have all of these old styles that we have to deal with, which earlier centuries didn't have to deal with. They had been lost or, you know, been put aside, added to which you have composers writing today. It simply means we've got to expand as much as we can our ears. We've got to encourage our choirs not to simply sing those same 15 anthems that they've always sung. Nothing wrong with the 15, but let's add some more to them. We've got to expand what we do in hymns to include that. We are a people who are fad conscious, and when the guitars came into vogue, someone said to me, well, the organ's out now. I said, watch. But I said, give me a couple years. Don't watch just for a day, you know. And nothing wrong with the guitars, but that comes up and then it goes down. Something else comes up and goes down. I mean, these things have a way of going in cycles. We were for about 10 years in a big thing in classical music emphasizing Baroque very strongly. That's not so strong anymore. It is still around, yes, but the new thing that you will see more and more coming up is 19th century You just watch. The next 10 years or so, 19th century music, Mendelssohn, sort of out of vogue, coming back. In our concert halls, we hear more of that kind of thing coming in. Schubert, Schumann. People get tired of one thing, they try another. They go back and forth. The same kind of thing ends up happening in our churches. And I think that we must be careful about how we are, quote unquote, with it. Because being with it can be very dangerous. What is supposedly the thing today could be something that is so passé that if we get too wedded to it, we're lost. I just believe so strongly in having a great diversity in what you do in music all the time. We had, for instance, at Plymouth one Sunday, well, I'll give you an example. In May, we had two Sundays. The first Sunday of May, the two anthems, we sang first of all a Bach motet, and then for the second anthem we sang a black spiritual. The next Sunday morning we did Mendelssohn and a Renaissance composer. You know, why not? They're all possible. You say, well, those things are, you've got a terrific choir and those things are, you know, much more difficult. The fact is, in all four of those styles that I'm talking about, there are easy pieces, and there are medium pieces, and there are hard pieces. And any church, I really believe it, as long as you've got, if you've got four singers, you got to have four, because you got to be able to do a soprano, alto, tenor, bass. But if you have four, you can make, you know, because there are little Renaissance pieces. When they did those Renaissance pieces back in those times, you know how many singers they had? Four. Maybe six or eight, if they were lucky. I mean, this was no massed choir thing. The thing that was fun to do back in those times, we've lost the art now for the most part, was for people to gather in homes and sing. And what did they sing? Madrigals, little Renaissance pieces. They all got together and did them. That was, you know, evening fun. No TV, no movies. Get together and sing madrigals. You know, the closest we come to it is the Beanie Sing, you know? It's wonderful that we have them, but that kind of thing of getting together. So we need to, whatever we do, try to look at the whole spectrum of choral music and get a little glimpse on what each period means, what it should mean, and then from there put it together, and hopefully it will make our church worship that much richer. Thanks.